Hello. 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 Hello.
Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
Welcome, everyone. It's the Karen Conti Show. Such a nice summer day. And I'm here with John DeCoste.
Hello.
You're going to be hanging around the entire show.
I always like this. This is fun. Thank you so much for asking me to do this.
This is fun. It's always a good time. You have a little shout out you want to do.
I do.
Tell me about your shout out.
Well, this is kind of cool. This is my good little friend, Isla Vicari, and her team. They all went up to Minneapolis this weekend. I think there were like 74, 75 softball teams, girls softball teams. The Crush Tidal Waves is the name of her team.
Wow.
I think they came in eighth. Out of all those teams, and they could have come higher. I think they got robbed or something like that.
Coach, that's nice. Was it 12-inch with the mitt or?
Yes.
12-inch with a mitt.
12-inch with a mitt.
Fast pitch,
yes.
Right.
And Nicole and Phil, their coaches, have done a phenomenal job. So they're all headed back. They're caravanning back.
Are they listening?
They are.
Can I hear them yell? Can I hear them?
I think so.
Go girls.
Go, yes.
Yeah, softball.
Go Crush Tidal Waves.
I love softball.
Did you play?
I played all summer long from, I don't know, age 12 or something. And then I played, I think, 4 years in high school. And we did really well. We had a really good team. I would like to have played college, but, I was too busy trying to get good grades to be a lawyer someday.
But you thought that was a priority. Okay.
Actually, I wasn't good enough. That's just my way of saying I really wasn't good enough.
I had to focus in on law.
I did have to focus in on law. But good. Congratulations, girls.
So, thank you so much.
Also, I just wanted to give a shout out to my husband, Jerry, who has a birthday tomorrow. And you know what? Jerry's looking at me and he's saying, he's like dagger eyes over there. He does not like birthdays. John, do you like birthdays?
I do. I don't know why. I don't make a big deal of it, but I do enjoy them. It doesn't bother me.
No, I like birthdays. See, I like when people make a big deal. I like making a big deal myself. Of course, I'm on the radio and I guess I do like attention for that matter. But I've said this a million times, but the first 10 you probably don't remember. The last 10 you probably would never remember.
That's a good point.
How many do you have in your life? Maybe a good 50 or 60 that you have one day that is yours, that you should be able to do whatever you want, should be able to celebrate, have your loved ones around you, and pamper yourself.
Has he given you any indication of what he wants?
He wants absolutely nothing, because if I buy him something, he will take it back.
So
yes, and he doesn't want to gather with people. He doesn't want to have a celebration. He said, "We'll go out to dinner, but we go out to dinner every night, so it's not much of a celebration."
So a little change of pace. Maybe go through a drive-through, Jerry. How about let's change it up?
Jerry likes the drive-through. I'm the one who doesn't like fast food.
Right?
Jerry's all about the. If it were up to him, it'd be Burger King every night. He'd be like wearing a crown, every day.
Okay, very good.
Well, happy birthday, Jerry.
Happy birthday.
Yes, happy birthday. We've got an interesting show. One of the things that we're going to start talking about at 7:30, and I'm going to pimp it a little bit, is this interesting study. And I've seen these studies before. And the study shows that it comes from the University of Chicago that people who talk to strangers on their commute, may find it a little difficult and awkward and don't want to do it. But if they do it, they're happier. And people who don't communicate with strangers are the least happy. The longer you talk to someone on your commute, a stranger, the happier you are.
It makes a lot of sense.
Do you think it does? Because that surprises me a little bit.
I think it takes some stress out of it. Once you relax and you're actually talking to somebody. Now, keep in mind, my whole life, yours as well, is basically talking to strangers. I have to go make them laugh.
Right.
So
that's,
I think about it.
That's a stressor. That's not easy to do. People think, oh, you're just naturally funny. No, you got to really work at it, don't you?
No, not me. I was naturally funny.
Okay. Except right now.
Except now. Except for tonight's show.
Except when the microphone's on.
I always pull it off. I pull back when I get here.
Well, here's how I think about this. All day long, I'm talking to people.
Right.
I'm fighting with lawyers. I'm talking to clients. I'm answering emails. I mean, I probably talk to or communicate with, I don't know if I'm making this up, 60 people a day. And the last thing I want to do on my commute, whether it's in a taxi or a bus or the L, I don't want to sit around and talk to people, small talk. I want my quiet time. Not necessarily even if I'm reading something. I just want to be quiet and just look around and not talk to anybody.
I came downtown a couple of weeks ago to go to this finance guy, and I did not speak to anybody. I'm just like you. It's like, hey, you know what? It's okay. We got a commute here. I don't need to discuss. On the way back, I ran into a woman. Could not have been nicer. She approached me and started talking, and it was, I didn't even know, the ride went like that.
And it's delightful.
And it was. It really was.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wonder if people are a little bit reticent to do that these days just because they don't want to see, feel like they're harassing you or sexual harassing you or they're coming on to you, or maybe people are a little afraid. We're all so sensitive about politics and things. I know when I, in my office building, John, I have this, I don't know if you've seen them, they're little TV screens, and they're news. They're news updates.
Oh, sure. Right.
And they have advertisements which pay for, you know, the whole thing. And I see people react to some of the news stories, and sometimes people turn and say, what do you think of that? And I really don't want to talk to them about it because I don't know what they think, and I don't want to be in a very close space with someone and start talking politics.
I actually agree with that. I do.
You know,
I don't want to get into that.
Not that I wouldn't be friendly to them in return.
And they're probably wrong, right? I mean, that's the other thing.
Well, you're always right. No, it's but I have had some wonderful experiences, especially on an airplane, because airplanes to me are a safe haven. We're all going somewhere, whether it's we're all going on business or we're all going on a vacation. You're stuck with someone, you know, on in the row. You're very close to that person,
yep.
And sometimes it's almost uncomfortable not to just say hi. Open up a little bit of a dialogue, not that you want to be talking for 16 hours all the way to Prague or something, but I have had wonderful conversations and met interesting people that way.
Well, then also take people who go on vacations or they travel or whatever. A lot of times they will tell you, oh, we saw this great place, but some of the best vacations are when they come back and say, we met this couple.
Yes, that's true.
We met this other couple from so-and-so, and then they'll talk about it, and it's pretty cool.
No, that is very true, and Jerry is a person who will always, in an elevator, he will start talking to someone, hey, that's a great tattoo. What does that mean? You know, I'm just going, oh, gosh, Jerry. But he just loves to talk
except
to people.
Except on his birthday.
No, not on his birthday.
Yeah.
When we come back, we're going to be talking about this really interesting auction that happened. Ebony and Jet, the two magazines geared toward the African-American community, Johnson Publishing. It went bankrupt, and the bankruptcy trustee conducted an auction of 4 million photographs that really document the African-American history in the last 50 or so years, politicians, celebrities, sports stars, and it all got bought by foundations. So we're going to talk a little bit about what's in that interesting group of documents. And I want to say again, happy birthday to Jerry. When we come back, we'll be talking to Miriam Stein, the bankruptcy trustee for the Johnson Publishing. It's Karen Conti Show on WGN. Bit of Chicago history. Ebony and Jet magazine were founded by the Chicago-based Johnson Publishing in 1945 and 1951. They were publications basically geared toward the African-American market. The magazines were sold a couple of years ago to a private equity firm, but Johnson still maintained an archive of over 4 million prints and negatives that documented African-American lives throughout 70 years. In April, Johnson filed for bankruptcy. The collection went into auction this past week, and I'm going to talk a little bit about what happened and where those photographs are going with the bankruptcy trustee, Miriam Stein. Hi, Miriam. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So Marion Stein is a partner in a law firm here in Chicago, and she is in charge of the bankrupt estate. And can you tell us a little bit about just a background as what a bankruptcy trustee actually does in a case like this?
Sure. So I was appointed as the bankruptcy trustee, and as the trustee, I'm in charge of assessing what the assets are in the bankruptcy estate and liquidating those assets for the benefit of creditors.
And when you do that, Miriam, do you have to, I imagine that your priority is to get as much money as possible so that the estate can pay off all of the debts that it's incurred. Is that fair?
It is fair. And, you know, sometimes we're able to do that and sometimes not. But in this case, I've met with Linda Johnson Rice on multiple occasions. met with her staff, assessed what the assets were, and I was fairly certain we would bring in some value for the estate. You know, I would just wasn't sure how much we would bring in.
So tell our listeners what happened. It was in the newspaper, but go ahead and tell us who bought all of those photographs and negatives and for how much.
Sure. So the Johnson Publishing was marketing these assets for quite some time prior to the bankruptcy when I came in, and without much success. We brought in an auctioneer, Hilco Stream Bank, and from about May through the time of the auction, which was this past week, we have been reaching out to foundations, companies, high net worth individuals, anyone which may have an interest in these assets, museums, et cetera. And I knew how special these assets were. I knew that the Johnson family had taken such care in preserving the assets. There's about 4 million pictures here that really covered the whole African American experience in America from the 1940s through 2016. So it was just, I believe it's one of the largest, if not the largest, collection of its kind. And I knew in the right hands we could do really amazing things with this collection. We were contacted a couple weeks ago from the Getty Foundation, who had sent a couple people to come look at the archive. And then in the end, it was a conglomerate of four foundations that ended up buying these assets, Ford, Getty, the MacArthur Foundation, and the Mellon Foundation. And together, they were the highest and best offer for these assets. And their intention is to digitize the collection and make it available for the public, both online and in museums.
Well, that's just, what a fabulous thing to do. And for that, what did they pay?
They paid $30 million. We closed on the sale on Friday. It was really exciting that, you know, the archive was sold to the right buyer at the right price that really value of this archive and saw the care and the attention that the Johnson family put into it, and really saw the potential of what this archive could do for years to come.
Well, you know, it just sounds like a total win-win-win in that you got the most money you could, which is a lot of money that's going to help pay off some of the debts of the company, which is your job and good for you. And it was purchased by these great foundations that are going to make everyone be able to see this stuff for free. I mean, what a great thing that these foundations do. It just I just can't say enough about how wonderful this is.
I know. It was really amazing. And part of, you know, our consideration for the best buyer for these assets was what they were going to do with the assets. And we talked a lot, my team talked a lot about, you know, what to do if one party was going to pay more versus another party that was going to pay less but make it public. And the fact that we were able to sell it to a buyer that married the two with the highest price and the best use of the archive was just such a fantastic win and outcome for this case that, you know, we were pretty amazed and certainly very pleased.
And Miriam, it's just from your standpoint, I would imagine being part of kind of this historic preservation, if you will, of amazing African American history. I mean, you're kind of part of it. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, no, it's really cool. I mean, I've been doing this trustee work for quite some time, and this has been the most rewarding case that I've been on. My counsel, Neville Reed, is also a bankruptcy trustee, and he would agree that this is probably the most rewarding case that we've worked on. We're continuing to work. We still have assets to sell in the bankruptcy case, but this was by far the largest asset and certainly the most well-known.
So can you tell our listeners just a little bit about some examples of types of photographs that were sold at this auction and that will at some point be made available to the public?
Sure. So the archive is archived by subject matter. So it's alphabetical by person and by general subject that the photographs cover. And it's an amazing collection that covers both the politics. So you have Malcolm X pictures, and you have Martin Luther King pictures. You certainly have the Emmett Till pictures, which were just very moving and incredible to see. Then you have, you know, just the opposite side of the spectrum. You have celebrities. You have Gladys Knight, I saw, Aretha Franklin, Sidney Poitier. You've got, and then you have athletes. You know, there was a whole Michael Jordan collection, obviously, you know, close ties to Chicago, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Muhammad Ali pictures. It's just amazing. I mean, we went into the collection, and I brought different people at different times, and everyone had their special box that they wanted to look at, you know, by person or by subject matter. And it just, you know, what can I say? It was breathtaking, and it continued to be amazing every single time I saw it.
Well, that's a great result. I'm very happy to hear this, and thank you for joining us and talking about this. Miriam Stein is a partner at Chuhak & Texan. Thank you for joining us, and congratulations on a job well done for not only your client but also for the city of Chicago and actually for the nation. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, take care, and thanks for joining us on your trip.
All right, thanks again.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. So let's take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking more with John DeCoste, and then we're going to be talking about that study that shows that talking to strangers, mom told you not to talk to strangers, but she was wrong because it makes you happier. This is the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Yeah, your mother told you that, right, John? Don't talk to strangers.
Who chose that song? Was that you?
That's me.
That was.
Awesome. I'm the musical director.
I love it. I'm the musical director of the Cochran Show, so we have a lot in common.
I get paid extra for that.
That was good. That was very good.
So yeah, your mother said don't talk to strangers, but mother does not know best because this new study that came out from the University of Chicago, it shows that talking to strangers is really a good way to have a better day. Here's what the study showed. Some commuters were instructed to have a conversation with the person who sat next to them. Some were told to keep to themselves and just hang out, enjoy the solitude, and others were told to do whatever they normally do. And then they were asked to rate their experiences on their commute. And of the three groups, the people who engaged in conversation reported the most positive train ride, the people who had the solitude, most negative. And the study showed that the longer you talk to somebody, the more positive the train ride was. And we're going to be talking to someone who's an expert in these kinds of social experiments, Dr. Eric Wesselman. He's a PhD associate professor of psychology at Illinois State. He publishes on research on various topics such as social exclusion, stigma, religion, spirituality. And we welcome him to the Karen Conti Show. Hi, Eric. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
So this study, is this a surprise to you, or is this something that you psychology people have known for years?
Well, we've known for a long time that humans are social by nature, that we hunger for belonging, for social connection. And there are various ways that we can satisfy that need. And interacting with fellow passersby, for example, can be one way of doing it.
So just trying to go back to like the Darwinistic, you know, view of this, like what is it about the human being that needs social interaction, harkening back to the days, you know, thousands of years ago? Why is it that we have that chip in our DNA that we want to be social?
Well, sort of going back to human evolutionary history, we needed other people to survive. You know, so it's not just that we like to connect with others, but we need each other to protect each other from, you know, predators, from roving bands of other humans who may want to take what we have, but also, you know, I can do something well, but very few of us are great at everything. You know, so I may need someone who is, you know, good at farming, and someone who's good at hunting, and someone who's good at creating shelters, and we, you know, sort of exchange labor that way. So that's sort of where a lot of researchers come at this from, that we needed each other for survival.
And I would imagine that because of all the automatization and in the technical things, and we can go to the grocery store and buy our food, we don't have to rely on farmers, and we don't have to rely on people to have those things. We can live a more solitary life, that maybe we've lost a little bit of that drive to socially interact.
I'm not sure if we've necessarily lost the drive to socially interact. I mean, there's just different ways of interacting now that we didn't have before, and technology being a big opportunity in that regard. It just sort of diversifies the way that we can connect with others.
Sure.
Eric, I have a question for you because, you know, I knew we were going to be talking about this tonight, and my wife and I take our dogs to the dog park, and it's kind of funny. We kind of joke about it. We take the dogs there to socialize. I, however, become very anti-social. I don't want to talk to anybody with my dogs. I don't want to go through this and whatever. But what I realized today was that by not communicating, there was a lot of stress trying to avoid conversations. And then you feel bad about yourself because, you know, these people are nice. They're trying to talk to you. We're all in the same place. And then after a while, like, I start looking inward and going, man, what's wrong with me? Why am I being such a jerk? So that's all negative. So I would have been better talking to these people.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, we definitely have a need to belong. We also, as you noted, there are times where we want to be alone, where we want to kind of shut out the noise of the world and just kind of have, you know, our personal time. And when you're around others, like at a dog park, there are social norms that if someone talks to you, you are obligated to make some sort of response, and if you don't, then you feel bad about yourself. So it is sort of an interesting catch-22.
And you know, have you ever, and I'm kind of with John, because I said earlier in the show that I, as a lawyer, I'm communicating all day long, sometimes, you know, 10, 11 hours a day. I'm talking on the phone, I'm emailing people, I'm reading, I'm writing, I'm communicating, I'm in court trying to argue with people. So my time when I'm commuting, whether it's in a cab or a public transportation, I feel like it's my private time. And I really, sometimes I don't even want to read anything. I just want to just look out the window, look at our beautiful city, and just not communicate. Although I have had experiences where I say I've been in a bad mood and I just want to force myself to be friendly to people. And when I do that, I am happier. You start talking to the cab driver, where are you from? What's going on? Was it a busy day? And all of a sudden, you know, you get out and you feel a little bit better about the world. So I think there's something about forcing yourself sometimes to do that.
Also, I don't, you know, I'm a stand-up comic, so I try not to tell anybody what I do because they find that fascinating. And in reality, I really want to hear what they're doing. They think, oh, no, you don't want to hear that. It's mundane. It's nothing. No, I do. I do. What I do is what I do. But I love hearing about other people.
Sure.
So, you know, that's fun.
And, you know, Eric, I wanted to ask you this. So this study talks about talking to random people, strangers, and I'm assuming that a conversation would probably be pretty light and pretty much small talk. Would this study be different if, let's just say, would it make me happier to talk for 10 minutes to somebody randomly on a bus or call my best friend and talk to her for 10 minutes? Which do you think, I mean, is there a point where the intimacy of the conversation will drive the happiness?
I think, you know, a lot of it depends upon, you know, what you need at the time. And in general, there are some researchers who will talk about social interactions as, you know, if we think of this need to belong as almost like hungering for social interaction, our social interactions are like food. And so, you know, if I'm feeling a little bit hungry, I could eat a snack. You know, maybe it's not the most healthy thing, but it gives me that quick burst. Or I could eat something a little bit more nutritious. If we sort of take that into the sort of interpersonal realm, you know, I could have a brief cursory interaction with a stranger or a Facebook friend or, you know, something that is kind of light. But I wouldn't necessarily want to do that for a long period of time. If all I had was sort of these cursory, light interactions, I would still not be fulfilling that need the way I should. So, you know, it's good to have those snacks, but you can't subsist on that alone.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. And let me ask you this about the, you know, we've talked about this over and over on my show. It's kind of a constant theme. And John DeCoss here, who is a stand-up comic, we've talked about how people are so very sensitive politically. And I don't talk about politics on this show. You know, it's just, it's going nowhere. Even when I don't talk politics, people think I'm talking politics. And they perceive that I'm talking politics. And so, and John DeCoss, you know, being political on, yes, on the stage is just, you're going nowhere with,
right,
that, because it's just so polarized. How, in your studies and what you do, and I've looked at some of your you know, things that you've done and things that you talk about, how has that affected human interaction generally?
Well, talking about divisive, sensitive topics certainly is a way to get one's emotions going. And I think it's probably best to just kind of know your boundaries and know who you're talking to, right? So as we go through our interactions, as we develop more intimate relationships with people, we know what are sort of the hot button topics, the social landmines that we choose to avoid with some people. And, we know other relationships where we can feel comfortable, being vulnerable, sort of showing, what our inner thoughts are that may be a little bit upsetting. And we know, can they handle that? Is this going to be a, maybe it's a heated but respectful conversation, or is it just going to devolve into name calling? Right. So we sort of learn that. In terms of interacting with these sort of cursory stranger relationships, if you're going to strike up a conversation with someone you don't know that well, it's probably just good to avoid those types of topics.
Yep, it makes sense. If you have any questions for Eric or have something to weigh in on in this conversation, you can call me here at 312-981-7200 or text to 981-7200. Eric, can you hold for a little bit? We're going to take a break.
Sure.
All right. Take care. We'll be right back. This is the Karen Conti Show.
Strangers in the night, exchanging glances, wandering in the night. What were the chances we'd be sharing love before the night was...
I'm picturing this. I'm talking to someone on the bus, the State Street bus, and all of a sudden, we're in love. No, I don't picture that at all. No, I really don't. Dr. Eric Wesselman is with us, and we're talking about talking to strangers and how this is a new study that shows that talking to strangers makes you happy. It's something you're connecting with people. You're being social. We're being our social animal best self. Dr. Wesselman, there was also another article that I saw this week, and it talked about how we have an increasing number of seniors who are lonely and suicidal. It was just increasing numbers. Can you weigh on this? Does this, in your speculating, I guess, does this have something to do with that feeling of being isolated, not having someone to have social interactions with?
I think you're right. When you look at the research on loneliness and suicidal ideation, a big component does seem to be this feeling of social disconnection, of alienation, that leads to things like depression, feelings of meaninglessness. I think that's one contributor.
We have a texter from the 312 area code, mm-hmm, who said, you've touched on a couple of things I'm perplexed by. I'm 70, and I interact with people at the grocery store on the street, if fitting. It seems, though, the majority of millennials have no idea how to react. She says, this morning I was out walking my dog past a family, mother and father and young child. I simply said good morning. No response. No eye contact. It was only good morning, she says. Is there... it was only good morning. Not like, can I borrow $5? Right. No. What does that say? Is there some idea that the millennial generation is not very good at these social interactions?
I'm not sure about that particular literature, but just my own personal observations and musings, I think that... that is definitely something that people are concerned about, right? So, as I mentioned earlier, technology has given us lots of ways to connect with others in ways that we feel comfortable with. But I do think that if one only spends their time connecting with others through some sort of device like a smartphone or social networking, that maybe they do lose something of interpersonal face-to-face interaction skills, the art of small talk and things like that, that may, perhaps they're just not getting practice doing. And that is something that we as a society will have to think hard about and to figure out how to address that.
Because you're right. I'm comparing having an email conversation with a friend of mine on a Monday morning versus talking to someone in the elevator. You look nice today. I like your shoes. Oh, it's a nice day out. Small, stupid talk. But you feel better after that personal connection, and much better than even the email with somebody who you know and who knows you, because I don't know what it is, if it's something that is actually a visual thing. The eye contact is something that adds something to the communication that makes it more, makes the happiness in your brain trigger. I don't know. It's different.
Eric, you've done the study. So what changes are you making, or how has this affected you, or have you changed at all?
In terms of just minimal social interactions.
Right.
I think that some of the studies that I've done on eye contact with strangers, or what happens when you break communication with someone when you're talking and you check your cell phone, stuff like that, it has changed the way that I approach. So when I'm walking outside, I do try to make eye contact with people more, give them a nod. Maybe they don't nod back, and I try not to be offended by that. But I, just knowing that, staring through someone, ignoring them can be problematic. I especially wrestle with this when I'm, walking by perhaps people on, who are homeless, who may be asking for change. It's very easy to walk by that person and just ignore them, but so those are situations where I've really sort of tried to make active attempts to not ignore someone. In terms of phone usage, if I'm going to have my phone or if I'm expecting a text from someone, what I will do is if I'm in the middle of a conversation, I'll tell them, if my phone goes off, hold on for a second, please. I need to check to make sure it's, not my spouse or my kid's school or something like that. And I think if you give someone that sort of warning, they know what to expect. It's not going to be as jarring if, they're in the middle of telling you a serious story and you just start texting, right? Because then they don't know what's going on. Are you not interested in them? It could be anything.
That's really a good point. And in my office, long ago, I made kind of a rule. It's a Karen's rule that when we're talking to a client, we don't bring our cell phone into the meeting. And a lot of my young people, they use it to tell time. They use it to calculate things. They'll use it to maybe check something, a filing online. I can check out, and it comes in handy when you have a client interview because you might want to be, getting information.
Right.
But what it does is it looks like you're not paying attention. It looks like you've got something better to do, especially the older people. I know people my age, when I see someone pull out a cell phone when I'm talking to them, I just think it's rude. And I know that I know they probably don't intend it to be rude, but I find it just, it's not something I like at all. It really is off-putting to me. Is that something that the younger generation, maybe they don't care so much about, but maybe the older generation does?
I think there's probably generational things. A lot of it is just expectation, which is why I think it's so important to, if I'm going to check my phone, to sort of let someone know, hey, I'm expecting a call from kids' school or whatever, so please don't be offended if I do this. I anticipate in some of my own research, I didn't really find much in terms of age effects. A lot of my work has been with millennial college students, and they definitely are students who still are bothered when they're fubbed, right? I don't think that it doesn't bother them at all. I think there's just different norms and expectations. So there may be an appropriate way of doing it that those of us who are not of that generation aren't savvy to.
There was a texter who said paying a compliment to a complete stranger can put a smile on two faces. It's so true. When you're in a bad mood and you just want to just try this, really, just walk up to your cab driver, your bus driver, someone on, I like your shoes, I like the way you look, or whatever it is. I'm telling you, it makes a difference. That person smiles, you smile, no harm. And it didn't cost anything.
That's true.
But on the other hand, I really think there's this mode of city mode and country mode. Like, I have a house in Wisconsin. When I go to Wisconsin, I'm not on my guard at all. So I will talk to people more readily than when I do in the city because, you're on your guard a little bit about someone trying to take advantage of you or, pickpocketing you or whatever it is. And so there's just a little bit of a shield that I think that I put up in the city, and I don't know, that's probably normal, I would imagine.
I think so. I hope so.
Eric, one final question. You talk a little bit in some of the things I saw online about being ostracized. Can you tell our audience, just define that in terms of how you have researched it and what it means in society?
So ostracism is a form of social exclusion. So we can almost think of it, we've been talking a lot about the need to belong and inclusion, ways of connecting with people. This is sort of like the polar opposite. And there are various ways to exclude people. It could be, giving negative attention to someone, insulting them or whatever. But in the context of ostracism particularly, my colleagues and I argue that's really characterized by being ignored. Right, so it's not only that you're just excluding me, you know, but you're treating me as if I don't exist, and that seems to be particularly poignant, right? Sort of the truism of, you know, bad attention is better than no attention. I mean, there seems to be something to that. You know, it's not great, but we would prefer that to being treated as if we were a ghost.
Interesting. That's a very interesting thing. And we could get into the whole bullying thing, yes. You know, and how that goes. But Dr. Eric Wesselman, thank you so much for joining us. And now we're not strangers anymore, but we can still talk. And I think we'll still make each other happy.
Excellent. That sounds wonderful. Yeah, thank you for having me.
Eric, if you see me on the street, don't say hi.
Okay. All right. I'll try to remember that.
Thanks.
No eye contact. All right. Take care. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show. Next hour, I will be taking your calls. I'm here with John DeCoste tonight. I'm a practicing lawyer. He's a stand-up comic. And we are going to be fielding your legal questions on anything you might have, friends, or your own legal issues or things you've seen in the news that you have questions about. There's a lot of interesting legal type topics going on with all the prosecutions. And I'm happy to weigh in. Maybe I can't give you the exact answer, but I can give you my opinion and hopefully steer you in the right direction. So let me give out the number. 312-981-7200, 981-7200, and you can text to that number as well. When you call, you'll talk to my producer, Ben. He's very good, and he will get you to give us your legal question as succinctly as possible so we can get just the facts that we need, and I can try to steer you in the right direction. And if you don't want to talk on the air, you can always call me at my office, and I do get back to everybody. I don't know that I miss a call or I don't get back to you. I mean, I always pretty much give you an answer, or I send you in the right direction, or I tell you I can't help you. And that number at the office is 312-332-7800. You might want to put that in your phone because you never know when you have a legal issue. And again, like, I don't practice in all the areas, but if it's something that I don't know how to practice or I don't take the case, I can always give you somebody who I know over 33 years of practicing who, you know, I trust, who's in maybe in your area, who I find that will be, you know, suitable for your case. Because going on the internet and Googling is not the way to find a lawyer. It's always word of mouth is the best way to get a good lawyer. So that number again is 312-332-7800. And my email, wgn@askkarenconti.com. KarenConti. John, you're here to get free legal advice.
Well, that's the best part about being a guest on your show is that I get to ask my questions.
Also, to put on the headphones. You like the headphones?
I do. Yeah. These are great.
Yeah.
These are great. And is that me talking?
Yeah, that's you talking.
That's pretty cool. Uh-huh. I sound like you. That's weird. So I do have a couple, two questions.
Okay.
Number one, you know the term deadbeat dad. Okay.
Yes.
The child support that they are supposed to pay.
Right.
Well, every once in a while, I'll see this on the news, and it's like, he hasn't paid for a year, or he's behind, and whatever. How can you be that far behind? When it's established that they have to pay, they know where that person works, right? I mean, isn't that how it's handled?
Well, there's a number of reasons this happens. First of all, you have to enforce it. If you're the recipient of child support, and listen, these days we have men paying child support, we have women paying child support. So when I use him or her, please forgive me because it goes both ways. There usually is an order that is established and it's in writing and it says you have to pay this much money per month, per week, per whatever. And then what happens is if you have a job where you get a check, there's a withholding order. So that money comes directly from the employer. So before you even, as a dad, you get your check, that money is taken out.
Right.
It goes to a state disbursement unit, and then it gets dispersed to the custodial parent. Okay, that's how it generally works. But what happens all the time is we have people who don't get a paycheck. We have people who work for themselves, right?
Okay.
So they stop paying. All right. They're ordered to do it and they stop paying. Another way that this happens is that they switch jobs. And now you don't have a withholding order against ABC company. Now you're a DEF company. And so the recipient of child support would have to hire a lawyer or on their own do a withholding order. And, you know, they should make this easier for people, right? They should make it simple that when you transfer jobs, it's your obligation as the payer to have that withholding order entered against your new employer. But instead, it's the person who gets the child support who has to go back to court and make sure that that gets entered, or at least have it entered against the new employer. So then there's another situation where people lose a job. Maybe they're out of work for 2 or 3 months. Well, they're not paying child support because they don't have the money and they don't feel like they have to pay the support because they're not working.
Right.
The truth of the matter is, unless the court order is vacated or changed, that obligation is ongoing.
Okay,
so just because you're not working, the court's not going to say, oh, well, your kid doesn't get to eat. No, you have to keep paying, whether that's from your savings, or your other option is to go back to court and ask the court to abate or reduce child support during that time period so that you're not in violation of court orders. So I have to tell you, John, I have seen cases where we've had over $250,000 of support ordered. And we're not talking about R. Kelly, because it's easy to see how that got so high so fast, because he had large child support obligations due to all of his royalties that he makes. So that doesn't, you know, that's not even a lot. $160 or whatever he owed at some point was not a lot compared to some of these guys who I see have avoided it for 10 years. They stop paying. And sometimes the parent who has the children will say, you know what, I don't have the money to go back to court. I don't know how to do it myself. I've had enough with this divorce. I'll just do it myself. And then at some point, they go, you know what, he owes me $100,000.
Right.
Now I need it for college. Now, wouldn't it be nice to just have this money? And so people then go back to try to get it. And then there's interest, and it's huge interest. It's 9% interest, which, you know, where do you get 9% interest these days?
Right.
And if you compound it and you do all that stuff, some of these people owe so much that it's almost impossible for them ever to pay it off. And you run the risk of going to jail, because a judge could say, listen, like you did with R. Kelly, you either come up with an amount of money right now to show a good faith attempt to make this payment, or you're going to Cook County Jail.
Wow.
Or you're going to the lockup. So the court can order you to liquidate assets. The court can order you to do all kinds of things. So on both sides of this issue, my advice is, if you're the payor, pay your child support. You know, I don't understand any excuse at all. You know, if you can't pay it because of some problem of yours, go to court and have it abated or reduced. Okay? That's what you should do immediately. You shouldn't wait. And for people who are recipients of child support, you too probably shouldn't wait. You should probably go back to court. And listen, the Cook County State's Attorney and some state's attorneys in various counties will have a free service where you can go and have the state's attorney actually collect the child support. So you don't even have to pay a lawyer to do it, which is a great thing. So you go to the Cook County website and there's a child support enforcement division. You can fill out paperwork. I haven't been on there in a long time. Or you can hire a private lawyer. Private lawyers are a little more aggressive and they move a little more quickly when it comes to these things.
Right.
But if you don't have the cash to do it, that's the way to do it.
Wow. Okay. That's fascinating.
So do you have you had another question?
Well, the other question, but this is not to get political, but subpoena. Is a subpoena a subpoena? And meaning that it seems to be like if I received a subpoena, I would have to, I mean, I have to go, right?
Yeah.
But that's not.
You shouldn't. It's subpoena is a legal, you know, a demand that you do something. You either go to court, or sometimes it's a subpoena for records, for documents.
Okay.
So, you know, whatever it says to do, you better do it. Because if you don't, a judge could say, we issue a bench warrant, which means they will send out a sheriff to arrest you, to bring you into court and testify or to produce documents. So why would you want to mess with that? If it says do something, you do it. Now, we got a bad example being set, right?
I know. That's what,
you know, we got a bad example being set. People are avoiding and ignoring subpoenas.
Okay.
You know, and the proper method is to move to quash. That's the word, not squash, but quash the subpoena. And, you know, if you have a legal a right to do that, you can do that, basically saying, you know, I shouldn't be forced to do this for one reason or another. But just avoiding it and ignoring a subpoena is illegal.
Okay.
It is illegal. And it's kind of, I hate to see bad examples being set, but you know,
I didn't want to get too involved, but yes.
Okay, I have one more question on the text, and then we're going to take a break, and we're going to get to everybody here. Fred and Westmont, I'm going to get to your question. Question for Karen Conti: our rental lease ends September 4th. If we decide not to renew, are we liable? The landlord is nutty and wants 60 days notice. When the lease ends, can we just leave without a 60-day notice? Thanks. Your lease is over at the date that it says on the lease. You should read your lease to say what happens when you leave. If you stay over one day, you're going to have what we call a month-to-month lease, meaning that now you don't have a year to your lease, you have a month-to-month lease, so that you have another 30 days that you're responsible for the rent and that they can't evict you. So the best thing to do with your nutty landlord is just to put it in writing, not a phone call, please, 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 in writing. Now that we have email, it's even easier, and say, we intend to vacate. We are not going to renew our lease, and we will be out by the 30th of the month or whatever the date is. So no, you won't be responsible. And if your lease says that you have to give 60 days notice of your intention not to renew, that's an unusual provision. But if it's in there, then you might want to honor it. I hope that is a good answer. Anyway, give us a call here, 981-7200. I'm taking text and phone messages, 312-981-7200. Any legal question you might have. I'm here with John DeCoste. It's Karen Conti on WGN. Welcome back. I'm here with John DeCoste, who's helping me answer legal questions. He's good moral support and immoral support.
I am not helping you at all. Why would you?
Well, you have some good questions. And, you know, a texter from 331 area code says, my ex is a stay-at-home mom and is paid zilch. Every time I ask her, she claims she can't afford it. Contacted my lawyer a couple weeks ago because of other stuff. Ugh is the word. So I take it, a texter, that she's a stay-at-home mom and is paid zilch. Does that mean she's paid? Who's paying child support? If she's a stay-at-home mom, does she have custody of the children? We don't use the word custody anymore, but does she have residential, more residential time? Are you paying child support? Or maybe he's saying that she's not paying for expenses, because most of the time, in addition to support, the parties are to divide up the extra expenses like insurance or uncovered medical bills or extracurricular activities or extraneous expenses like religious expenses and things like that. And I'm not quite sure, but it's frustrating. And you know what? A lot of people don't want to go back to court because it costs money and it's a big heartache. And people want to be over their divorce, and they sometimes are never over it. And that's a serious problem. I wish, if I had the magic wand, the magic legal wand, I would really like to make the process easy and user-friendly. You know, you have a court to go to. You can just go there without a lawyer. People have to bring their records. It gets decided. You know, there's no running around. And there's a ramification. If a judge says you have to pay and you don't, then there's a ramification to it. You know, I mean, I don't like throwing people in jail. I don't. That's not what I like. But I don't like when people think they can game the system and they come back over and over again. And, you know, here's the person who's there in court, you know, leaving their job to try to get their darn child support. And here's someone avoiding their obligations. It's just it causes disrespect for the system. And it's terrible for the children and terrible for the parties. So, but, you know, I don't know if that will ever remedy itself. Fred. Hi, Fred. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. You're from Westmont.
Hi, Karen. In 2014, on the day after Thanksgiving, my mother was killed in a hit-and-run car accident.
My gosh.
And
I'm so sorry.
My question is, I feel like the investigators and the police botched the investigation because they didn't charge the guy with anything. They said there was no DNA and whatsoever. And my question is there any statute of limitations where we can reopen the case again?
There is no statute of limitations in Illinois for a hit-and-run accident where there's injuries or damage. Okay. So there is no statute of limitations. There are a few cases, a few types of cases, murder, second degree murder, motor vehicle homicide, child pornography. Those are types of crimes along with this crime that do not have statute of limitations. So they can continue the investigation. I'm curious, and I'm really sorry to hear about this. It's got to just weigh on you that this person who killed your mother is out there driving around. But did you see that there was an article in the, I think it was the Tribune this week, about the number, the vast, like, majority of hit-and-run cases are unsolved? Did you happen to see that?
No, but after what I experienced, it's not surprising.
You know, why don't you email me at the office? Let me email you the link to that article. I wanted to actually talk about it on the show because it astounded me that those crimes were so infrequently solved. And again, I'm not saying that the police weren't doing their jobs, but, you know, you would think that there would be ways of catching these people either through witnesses or paint and all that kind of stuff. Can I ask, Fred, was there any evidence in this case? You said there was a gentleman that they actually tried to charge, or they suspected?
Yes, and according to my sister, the police called her and says he's at his father's house, and his father says he'll bring him in the next day. And he came in the next day to the police department with a lawyer.
And they didn't charge him?
That's one thing. And why would a hit and run where my mother was in a coma, why would they wait for him the next day? Why wouldn't they check him out for drugs right away? And that's what I don't get. That's why I say they botched this investigation. Right when he called, the father called or whatever, they should have went to his house and checked him for if he was on something or whatever.
You're right. Fred, why don't you, I'm going to put you, I'm going to hang up here and I'm going to listen. Are you listening to the radio?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I'm going to give out my email address. Email me, and I might have a couple other ideas for you about how to handle this. My email is wgn@askkarenconti.com. That's very sad, very, very sad. All right, let's go to Marge in Verona. Hi, Marge in Verona.
Hi, Karen. How are you?
Good. Where's Verona?
Verona is actually just a little bit south and west of Morris, Illinois, close to Seneca, Illinois.
Okay. There's a good antique store in Morris that I
need
to go
to. Not too far from there.
Yes. Okay. Why don't you give me your question, because we have a little echo here. I'm going to probably put you on hold.
Okay. A quick question. Okay. My husband and I, we own a small business. It's an LLC. We performed a service for a customer back in November of 2018. We did have a contract that was agreed upon for a price. He did not pay us for the service that we did. We own an audio company, sound company, so we did an event. He never paid us. So we did send we did get our lawyer involved. We did send a letter from the lawyer for collection. He did not respond. There was a court date set for, it was about 2 weeks ago, and he did get granted a judgment against him, and then 30 days to either pay or dispute. And then from that point on, I guess our lawyer is telling us that if nothing happens from then she would suggest collections, and that really isn't like her department, so we'd have to go further. What's your recommendation?
And Marge, just tell me how much it is, and I'm going to hang up.
It's a good amount of money. I mean, for a small business, it's $3,500.
Okay, Marge, I'm going to hang up on you here and listen to the radio. I don't know why we have a little echo here, but so this is the problem with collection. You can collect money by getting a judgment. That's the first part of it. You go to court and you prove that there was a contract. You prove that you performed the service, and you prove that they didn't pay. And so you get that judgment, and you think, oh, I'm home, right? This is good. The problem is now you have to collect it, okay? So if this person does not have any assets, it's very difficult to collect it. If this person has no income from a paycheck to paycheck standpoint, it's hard to garnish wages when someone maybe owns their own business or maybe is unemployed. And a lot of people who don't pay their bills, and you have to sue them. A lot of them don't have homes. They don't have cars. They don't have things to lean. They don't have income streams that are readily accessible. So you know, this is a real tough one because $3,500, gosh, that's a lot of money. You know, I would bend over and pick it up if it fell on the floor. But to go to court and to have collections handle it, they're going to take at least a third. And because it's such a small amount relatively, they may not even take your case because to do all the work they need for $1,000 or so may not be worth it. So my best advice to you is to, you know, maybe look into trying to do this yourself. Find out if this person has any assets. You can get a private investigator to run a search to see if he owns any property and see if there's a way to put a lien perhaps on his home. That might be the easiest way to do it. But again, that's a really tough thing. And remember, when you hire a lawyer to collect money, you got to not just get the judgment, you have to actually collect it. We're going to take a break. I'm here with John DeCoste tonight. I'm taking your legal calls, 312-981-7200. That's Glenn Campbell, right?
Yes.
The late, great Glenn Campbell. He was great. Remember Rhinestone Cowboy?
Yep.
Yeah.
Gentle on My Mind.
Oh, yeah.
Wichita lineman.
I never understood that. What a Wichita lineman. And why is he still on the line? I don't know. I should look that up. Okay, I'm taking your legal questions, 981-7200. That's John DeCoste, who's laughing here. Let's talk to Catherine in Chicago. She's got a question about a deed with her name spelled incorrectly. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, good. What's your question?
Okay, what the situation is for 30 years, my name has been C-A-T-H-E-L-I-N-E. And for 31 years, it's been R-I-N-E. Now, I have everything in Catherine, passport, you know, accounts, driver's license in Catherine. But there's four things that are left in Cap Line. And that's the birth certificate, the marriage, the Social Security card, and the title on our first home. My question is, how do I pursue this? Now, from what I've read in the law, July 1st of 2010, there's no longer anything common law is invalid. But my name, Catherine, has been Catherine on legal documents for 31 years.
Okay,
so my question is, how does that law apply? And then should I change this? When reference to what should I change first in reference to change the SS card, marriage certificate, title, and birth certificate?
You know, that's each one of those is a separate answer, and I'm not sure I'm going to be able to guide you on that.
Okay.
I do know that on a deed, there's a couple ways you can do that. You would probably call the recorder of deeds. Is this in Cook County?
Yes, it is.
Okay. They're very helpful, actually. You can call them or you could walk into the recorder of deeds office, and they have a form that's like a corrective form. You can either take the deed you already have, cross out the name and write on top of it the correct spelling, or you could just do a new deed, and you can do it that way. They will give you a form for that, and I believe there's a cover page that you need to fill out to show and to tell everyone why you're changing the name on the deed. I know that. Okay. So now you mm-hmm. have other things. You have the marriage certificate?
Yes.
Okay. And is it important?
It's also Cook County.
And I would just walk into the vital records and see how they do it there because I don't know how to do that. Is that something that is important to you? And why is it important to you?
Because when we go to sell the home, I just don't want any snags.
Yes, got it.
With the SS card, yeah.
Okay.
No snags.
Yeah.
With the SS card, I want to make sure my benefits are secured.
And that's something... So that is something that you're going to, that's going to be a matter of Social Security. And my understanding of that is, you know, I would just go online. Talking to them on the phone is very difficult. I would go and see what you can glean from their website about changing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're going to probably have to go to one of the offices and sit there and wait. And I know the waits can be 2 or 3 hours. So my advice to you from personal experience is to maybe go to a suburban place, because if you go downtown, even if you get there in the morning, sometimes the wait is just horrendous. And bring some
I thought of the Milwaukee location. I don't know if that's any better. But then there's Hillside. That's roughly where the two are that I go to.
Yeah. And you know, bring a book, you know.
Yes.
And just be willing to just sit there and wait, because that's the best way to do it, is to face-to-face someone. But when you go, make sure you have all of the information, all of the documents that they're going to need. And they may require, like, birth certificates and things like that. But I'm sorry.
Which I have already set aside.
Well, good. Mm-hmm. And so hope that helps a little bit. I'm sorry I can't give you absolute specific advice on that. But good luck.
Okay.
All right.
You've gotten, okay. And then the birth certificate, is that the hardest part?
You know,
I was born in Chicago Heights.
You've changed your name by usage, is what you're telling me.
Well, the common law is by the 14th Amendment. Accordingly, we have the right to do that. But it's been more years than I've had it as a birth name.
Okay,
so
all
more
you're
years,
saying,
Catherine.
Yeah, you're using a slightly different name than you were born with, right? That's so
one letter.
One letter. Yeah. No. I'm not criticizing you. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
so you'd have to go back and do that. And I'm sure there's a way to do a corrective birth certificate. And again, you might want to go to the vital records. This might be a day for you to go downtown and go to the Cody building and just know, wait in line.
So I'd have to go to Chicago Heights, right? Because I wouldn't. It's not in. Would the county building be over Chicago Heights, because they are in Cook County,
you know,
or would I have to go to
I don't know.
Village of.
You might have to go to that's where you were born, the Village of.
Yeah.
That
St. James Hospital in that area.
You know what? Why don't
that's
you do
where
this?
The town is.
Why don't you email me, and I will see if I can get you some better answers to where you go with this birth certificate thing, because I know somebody who would know the answer to this. Okay?
Oh, thank you.
Okay, I'm going to drop you, and I'm going to give out my email address, WGN@AskKarenConti.com, and I'm going to spell my name the right way, KarenConti. All right, let's go to Robert in Shorewood. Hi, Robert. How are you?
Hi. I have a specific question that is a very traumatic question. I was put on Social Security disability in 1980. My mother created a special needs trust for me. The disability never ended. It continued from the 80s to the present day. It went into a circuit courtroom in Will County. How in the world can a circuit court judge break a special needs trust for someone who's been disabled? I then filed a police report, and the Will County State's Attorney's Office refused to do an investigation. And Karen, today, I'm 6 months behind on my mortgage payment, and I haven't paid my Will County property tax. How is any of this possible? Even the transcript of the hearing is fraud from the first page to the last. I answered three questions.
Okay.
My name, the name of my mother, and an open question of what my mother would say. And there was no emotional emergency or anything to break the stress.
Robert, let me just ask you, I don't know the answer to this because I would need to know more, and I'm probably going to ask you to call my office. But let me just try to get into this. A special needs trust, for the listeners out there, is a trust that is designed to protect a person's assets. If you have special needs and you get government money, say, for instance, the Social Security money, if it protects that money from having to be paid back. So what was up in court that allowed the judge to visit the issue of whether or not the trust could be breached? He's off. Okay. Ben, if he calls back, just give him my WGN@AskKarenConti.com. I'm not sure of the facts there. It sounds like he's saying that a judge pierced that trust and required the trust to pay certain expenses, and I don't know why. And it could be that the trust wasn't properly set up. It could be that I don't know. It's just speculation. But that's the best I can do on that. Sorry to hear that. Let's see. My friend, this is from a texter in 708. Hope all is well. My friend has been going through a divorce for 4 years. She's not collecting child support for daycare, and all her money is going toward daycare. She said she reached out to you for advice. I guess you were very responsive, but couldn't help because she's in some other county, I think is what the texter said. So basically, if you are entitled to child support, the judges will usually say that in addition to child support, you can ask for daycare expenses as well, because both parties need to go to work, right? Both parties need to support their children. And the only way a custodial parent, and I use the word custodial, even though that's not the word we use anymore, but people understand what
right,
I'm saying.
Right.
You have the children the majority of the time. The only way you can go to work is if you have daycare, right? So it's very expensive, very, very expensive. Even the cheap daycares are very expensive. So usually the dad, and I'll say the dad, but it could be the mom, has to also pay, in addition to child support, usually half or so of the daycare expenses. So maybe this person needs to go back to court to collect the daycare. I don't know if it's in the court order, if she needs to get a court order that requires that. But again, you should keep all of your records. You should keep them together of how much it costs and make the demand on the dad here. And if he doesn't pay, then hopefully maybe you can even use the state's attorney for free to get that paid for.
Does it change that much from county to county?
Well, no, a little bit. Okay. The Illinois law is the Illinois law, which applies up and down the state. But different counties will enforce laws differently, and different judges enforce the laws differently.
Okay.
Some judges will come down really hard. Some judges will just let it ride. The issue of does the state's attorney have a free service, that also varies from county to county. So I'm kind of giving general advice
right,
here,
right,
knowing that there might be a slight difference in how these things are done. One more from a texter in the 616 area code. Where's that? I think that's Grand Rapids, Michigan, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not sure. I just took a guess. Keeping it short, father of the child is not on the birth certificate. He's not providing any financial support, but lives in the home owned by mother. Pays part of the mortgage, but nothing else. Food, insurance, anything child-related. I'll have to evict at this point. What rights to the child will he have? I feel like he's using the child as courtroom bargaining chip. All right, so the father, they've not been married. So what you probably have to do is you first maybe want to file, I don't know if you want to file the eviction first. If someone is in your house, you can't kick them out without a court procedure. A lot
really?
Of people don't get this. You know, you have, you know, maybe as a favor, you have your, you know, brother-in-law, your ne'er-do-well brother-in-law come into the house. Well, you're going to have to evict him even if he's not paying rent. Rent has nothing to do with it.
You're kidding.
No, that's why these good Samaritans who say, I'll take somebody in, they police will not enforce anything. You can't change the locks. The police would require you to open the door for somebody who's been living there. So you have to get him out, first of all. Maybe at the same time, you file what we call a paternity action. You have to declare him to be the father of the child. Since there's nothing been in court that says that he's the father, you need to declare paternity. And then you need to ask for child support. And you need to do this sooner rather than later, because it dates back, the ability to get child support dates back from the date that you file. So the faster you file, the better off you are. And you can ask for child support, which is based on the income of both parties. You can ask for extracurricular expenses. It sounds like a younger child, so that might not be relevant. But medical insurance, a contribution to medical expenses, maybe even birth and labor, delivery costs, and then daycare as well, as we talked about. So there's a lot that you have to do, this eviction and going to court to get your support order in place. And again, people really don't like doing this because it costs money. But I tell people you should really put it on a credit card, borrow money from a parent, because you need to establish this right away. And what are his rights? His rights are he's going to be able to visit this child.
Right.
And the court is going to set that parenting schedule based upon the status quo. How often has he seen the child? How often are you home? What is the schedule for both parties? The judge could send it to mediation, so a mediator could help you resolve that. But yes, he will be entitled to see the child. And that's just the natural and the right thing, unless he's unfit, you know, unless he has a drinking problem, alcohol problem, or drug problem, or he's abusive in some way, he is going to be able to get to see the child. We have some more time left. Give us a call here, 981-7200. Any legal question you might have. I'm here with John DeCoste. It's the Karen Conti Show. night would be a nice night to drive down Lakeshore Drive. The top down. I mean, not my top down, but my car's top down.
Whatever.
I don't want to be violating any laws, any more laws than I normally do. All right. So we have 815. Hi, Karen. I was involved in a motor vehicle accident 2 years ago. The other guy got the ticket. I was in a work vehicle, and my lawyer tells me that my car insurance and my Medicare will pick up my bills because the man who hit me only had a minimum amount of insurance. Why isn't my employer's insurance paying the bills if I was working at the time of the accident? Thank you, Sandy. Sandy, you're right. You know, but did you bring a lawsuit 2 years ago? 2 years is the statute of limitations for a motor vehicle accident. You could have sued that other guy, even if he had less, you know, not too much in insurance, because you could have gotten money there. And then to the extent that your Medicare paid for your expenses and your medical bills, they would have been negotiated down. You should have brought the lawsuit against the guy who hit you. If you still have time, let me know. I can refer you to somebody who'll do that. Second is, your employer's insurance should be paying the bills and should be paying you for your accident. This is workers' compensation. If you are actually in the course of your employment, not going to work or going back from work, but actually in the course of your employment, then that it should be a workers' compensation issue. I'm not kind of unsure why you haven't consulted a lawyer before, because they should have been paying your bills, and then they're going to owe you money for a lump sum settlement for any permanency. So if you have any continued pain or continued scarring or anything like that, they would have to pay. Again, send me an email, and I can refer you to a lawyer who may be able to give you a better answer with more details and more facts. Hopefully that will resolve itself. Okay, let's go to Lucy in Chicago. Hi, Lucy.
Hi. Hi, Karen. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. What's your little question?
Okay, this is a situation I've been dealing with in the last 30 days. Basically, I have a home. It's a summer home that is in Michigan. I live in Chicago. I decided to put it up for sale. It sold fairly quickly. We went to the closing on July 1st. Title company contacted me, saying everything was prepared to go. Everything with the lender approved. Ended up that the lender found that the manufactured home that I own wasn't recorded on title. I guess there's a title to this manufactured home, which we never know. It looks like a home. It's on concrete. It's attached, but I guess because it was manufactured somewhere else and brought there by the previous owner, it was never recorded that way. But I've been paying taxes on it, on the land and the property itself. So that's where I was confused. Now,
why didn't your real estate lawyer then just correct that by filing the correct deed?
Okay, that's where we are now. When this came about, we were going to closing, and it happened the same day. Ended up that the title of this manufactured home that's on my property, and I purchased 15 years ago, is still in the name of the previous owner who had the house built. She's now in California. We were lucky enough to find her that same day and was able to get power of attorney. This is my agent is handling this for me in contacting but the previous owner, got the power of attorney to go to Secretary of State to get a document. And now I've been waiting for almost, it's been a month, July 1st, we're at the month here. Okay. And I'm worried I'm going to lose my buyer.
This is really complicated. And it sounds like a glitch that, you know, obviously you didn't know about, but this stuff doesn't always happen quickly. You know, I don't know that I have any words of advice for you other than to stay on your lawyer and stay on the system to see if you can get it resolved, because it would be a shame that if you lost your sale. But again,
I should have got to correct it.
Yeah.
My question to you is, okay, I've been working with my agent's been handling this for me, and he's very sharp. But at this point, he's not communicating to me anymore, and I'm getting nervous. The closing itself would have been clean and easy going, but now this glitch came up. I don't have an attorney But I am looking for someone that's in Chicago that would represent me in Michigan. Do you know of anyone?
Hold on. I'm gonna put you on hold, and I'm going to give you the answer. So listen to the radio. First of all, you don't want a lawyer from Chicago to do a closing in Michigan, because you can't practice law where you're not licensed. So I can, if you send me an email at WGN@askkarenconti.com, I can find you a real estate lawyer in the county where this property is. I do some business with some people in Grand Rapids, in the Detroit area, and in the area around New Buffalo. So I have some lawyers that I can refer you. So just send me that email. And thanks for the call, Diane. I got to run. Thank you very much.